Well, it's starting to look like musical chairs in the political world, and we've got some things to vote on. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Hey, Barry, it's great to be back with you today. I have a little announcement to make why it's great to be back with you today. It's always great to be with you anyway, and the folks out there are listening in WLRY land and also on our podcast. And the podcasts are all caught up, so the archives are out there. If there's something you want to go back and listen to, go listen to them. They're all up. But that being the case, I'm a new granddad.
Congratulations! Woo!
Yes, my little granddaughter was born last Sunday, so almost a week ago by the time you hear this. And is Grandpa proud? Oh, you betcha she is. He is. Pardon me. Wow. I've not gone over into transgenderism.
Yeah. Now there's an explanation for that too, folks. You see, Grandpa has basically lost quite a bit of sleep here lately.
Yeah. Little Clara, my wife and I were just laughing. I said, for those who don't believe in original sin, we have witnessed it in a 5-day-old child. And we've also witnessed the fact that they do what they want when they want to and demand that you follow along. So we've been following along as she has decided certain issues that babies have to do. She doesn't want to do it. So I said, well, it's our first foray into sin, and it's our first foray into knowing that children have personalities.
And wills, that's right.
That's right. They have personalities and wills, which is exactly why they have original sin. So we're dealing with that, but Grandpa's going to get some more sleep, I think, because some of these issues, we've worked out little ways to get around them. And so, little Clara, love that name. The more I think about that name, I love that name. My daughter wanted something that not everybody was doing.
Well, I think she managed to land on one there, so.
Yeah, she said, my daughter is a historical thinker. She actually has a degree in history, and she worked for the Licking County Historical Society. And so she tends to think in historical terms, and they kicked around names that were not popular, but that they both liked. And so her middle name is something that's short, sweet, not always used. I'm not going to give it away just because I don't want people snooping around too much. But
no, I get that.
Like they won't be able to find her with Clara. But they kicked it around. She didn't want a Tiffany or Amber or, Kelsey or those kinds of things. And if you have children or grandchildren named that, well, then I'm not being critical. They just didn't want to go that direction. So they went with Clara. And we love it. So that's what's keeping me kind of dancing around here. And that and trying to get all the broadcast archives up to date.
Yeah, we're trying to do that public service for everybody.
That's right. Well, I figured out last night, I go, oh, gosh, I'm 6 episodes behind, and these are not quick to get up on the internet. It does take some time because I have to listen to them for little nuances and things to throw in the description. And so I listen to them at like double speed. So I go through one, and it takes me about half an hour to get each one up. So I spent, I don't know what, 3 hours last night getting stuff up on the internet while little Clara was being wrestled with at my kid's house with my wife. My wife was over there helping them wrestle their 7-pound infant, you know. So when I say wrestle, I don't mean they actually had her on the ground. Wrestling of wills, shall we say. Like her, both parents and grandparents, she is strong-willed, but she's subtle about it. This is so you have to recognize these things. And, you know, that brings up a good point. Every kid is different. I always love it when experts say, do this and this and this and this. Uh-huh. What they forget to tell you is, shape it to your child.
Yes.
Because of my 3, not a one of them has been anything like the other.
Of course not. We're the same way. You've got kids and they all have their unique abilities, they all have their unique personalities, and they all have their unique quirks.
Oh, quirks, yes.
Yeah,
yes, quirks, definitely. Yes. You find yourself having to give advice, the advice that one needs, the other two don't, and advice another one of them needs, the other two don't. So you continue to guide them even after they've all moved out, because our kids are all moved out. But hey, that's life. That's why we're here. That's the beauty of being a grandparent. I'm here for consultation. I'm here to co-sign loans. I'm here for that kind of stuff. But I don't to feed you anymore.
No doubt.
So.
No doubt.
It's a good thing. It's a very good
thing. Well, that is good. So, yeah, and I'm sure there's many who've been, you know, in similar shoes with having a first-time grandchild. Usually, when folks have a baby, they go to the hospital, they have the baby, and on TV, it's all wonderful and great, and the baby's all pink and healthy and great, and everybody goes home, and they're happy, and life just gets back to normal. But we all who've had kids know that's just not how
not
it works.
Not the case, yeah.
you know, life is a little messier than that, and so's having babies. And it's not so much the delivery part of it, it's the post-delivery part of it. You know, as I was laughing with you this morning as we were getting ready, I said, I really can see where family leave was a good idea, because when you, yeah. You know, it is. I mean, if you're a young couple and you're having your first child, like your daughter and her husband, you are now into a world you have never, ever, ever experienced in your life. And I don't care how many babysitting jobs your daughter might have had as a kid. I don't care how many little siblings they may have had. There's nothing like being responsible for another living human being.
Exactly.
Who's dependent upon you 24/7, 365, and is in constant demand.
Well,
so
I explained it to my kids. You know, they're in that abyss right now. You know, they're in the long fall into the hole that they didn't realize was there. And it's like, well, you can tell them all day long that that's what's going to happen, and they can't hear it until they're actually in headlong fall over this cliff. And I said, here, they were kind of having an emotional day, and I just said, hey,
oh yeah,
here's what you guys are experiencing. It's been about you two for over a year. It's been about nobody but you two. It's you two. And I said, suddenly there's this little interloper who shows up and demands every ounce of your attention that you were given to one another to be given to her. And I said, believe it or not, it sets up a hierarchy. Liz, my daughter, has to spend all of her time taking care of that baby, and you have to spend all your time taking care of her, of Liz, I told her husband. So things have completely changed, and it's a shock. And you're going to find out that now. I said, don't worry about this losing sleep and stuff. If you guys do it right, you'll be sleeping through the night at about 6 weeks. Now, some people don't get there that quick, but we had two of our kids that did that. I mean, we fed them on a schedule. We fed them on our schedule, not their schedule. We didn't demand feed, although if they got really, really demanding, we fed them. But for the most part, we kept them on a schedule, and I think within 6 weeks, the kids were sleeping through the night. So these milestones come and go, and I said, you know, as much as you're frustrated and you realize that you can no longer pay the attention to one another you used to pay and all that stuff, I said, it all gets worth it the first time you wake up in the morning and you go pick them up out of the crib and they smile at you.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you're like, oh gosh, now I remember why we did this. So, yeah. And I said,
exactly.
They'll keep you on your toes even after they move out of the house. They'll keep you on your toes. So, yeah, that's the beauty of it. And just be prepared, because there will be all kinds of surprises when they come in and their arm is cut wide open. You got to run them to the emergency room to have stitches put in it. Or they break a leg or, you know, something really dumb. I'm trying to think if we had broken bones. Yeah, we did. I think we had a broken finger. One of our girls playing basketball, I think. Yeah, broke a finger.
Oh, boy.
And both my youngest daughter and I have broken the same toe. So we joke about that. We got it differently, but we did that. So you joke about the broken bones, but it's not funny while it's happening. And it's these crises aren't funny while they're happening. But, you know, you deal with it.
Yeah, no, exactly. You have to, so. But, no, you're right. They're not funny while they're happening. Now, again, and I want to segue over into what we're going to talk about today, because there's an awful lot of things going on that aren't funny at all, but we got to talk about them. And first and foremost is the major news, Chuck, that just broke a couple days ago, that we had a state senator who abruptly resigned his seat, ostensibly for the purpose of his health. It's a standard thing. I'm having a health issue and I need to spend more time with my family. So I'm stepping down effective right now. Well, as you dug into that a little bit more, you found out that, well, that wasn't exactly the entirety of the rationale for why this individual, who is a longtime member of the legislature, served 8 years in the House and was in his second term in the state Senate, why he abruptly resigned. And it came out a couple of days later in a statement from him and his wife that he resigned because he was being faced with a complaint of sexual harassment of a female staffer in Columbus. That has created a lot of ripples, obviously, a lot of questions. You know, we're in this environment right now with the Harvey Weinstein situation. And if folks, if you don't know about that, that's the big time heavyweight Hollywood producer who now has gotten at least 30 different women who have said that during the time when they were coming up as actresses, that Harvey Weinstein was being sexually inappropriate with them. You're asking for favors,
yeah.
Inappropriate touching, innuendo, basically out and out, blackmail. And in a couple of instances that he actually did rape them. So you've got a situation going on right now where the entire public's, are the level of this rising to the top of the consciousness is right there. And so here we have the state senator who most people, if you had asked them before this broke, what do you think about this guy? They would have said, oh, he's a great guy. He's fun to be around. He likes everybody. He likes to be liked by everybody. And they would have said the one thing that I said when the reporter called me up to discuss this was that, well, he likes to hug everybody. He's a touchy-feely kind of guy in a good way. He hugs everybody, guys, girls, whatever. He's just gregarious in that respect.
Yeah.
Well, I guess this was a little bit more than being gregarious. This was more of the, he had been doing hugs and things with this gal, but he had also had a running commentary, I guess, that really turned it over to the idea that he was being inappropriate with a lady. And I won't say young lady because I don't know. I mean, this could have been a woman closer to his age. I have no idea. He's in his 60s. So the situation happened that Monday night, this announcement went out that he was resigning effective immediately. By Tuesday morning, it was starting to come out that, well, there was some background information, and our friends over at Third Rail Politics did a little digging, and they found out that there was a little incident before. Chuck, if you remember, here about, maybe 2 years ago, maybe three now at the most, if my memory serves me, although it doesn't serve me as well as it used to. There was this little situation about a, website that catered to people who were looking to, find greener pastures outside their marriages.
Ashley Madison.
That's the one. Well, it turns out that this senator's name showed up in that when that site was hacked and all that stuff was dumped out there. Now, and again, we have situations where you had a number of people who said that they had never been on the site, but somehow they had an account there. Well, that was the situation with this senator. His name showed up as an account holder on Ashley Madison, the adultery hookup site. That website was for people who were married, who were looking to have an affair. What came out though, Chuck, was this thing. It was run by, I think, a Canadian company, and basically most of the quote unquote, it was mainly guys signing up for the website, and most of the women that they were talking to and negotiating, trying to get together with to have an affair, were actually created bots.
Yeah.
Within the website.
They're fake accounts.
Were fake. This was a way to basically skim lots of money off of men who are, controlled by their libidos. And, if you've got somebody like that, it's easy to blackmail and extort them now, isn't it? So you've got this situation where this website was doing it, but then they got hacked by somebody, and I'm guessing it was probably a vengeful wife who found out that her husband was involved with this, who then hacked the site and dumped all of the account names online so that everybody got to see who was trying to get a hookup at Ashley Madison.
Yeah.
And the senator's name appeared. Now, I'm not stating his name, you know, for a reason, Chuck, because this thing's still developing and unfolding, and it could come out that there was less of this than meets the eye, and it could come out that there was more to this than meets the eye.
Right.
You know, you and I both have that situation, and this kind of bleeds into something I'm going to be talking about a little bit later when we talk about ballot issues. But, you know, this could be a situation that in our hyper... It's funny, Chuck. We live in these crazy juxtapositions now in this culture. We have a highly sexualized culture. I don't care where you turn, you're going to find it. You know, from your media to your marketing to everything, you know, that we sell. We're selling household items with sex now. I mean, it's just... It's pervasive in the culture. It's easy to find. The internet and smartphones has made it easy to basically be a voyeur or a predator 24/7 to exercise these darker desires and these temptations. And so we have this highly sexualized culture that now all of a sudden, because a few people were able to stop and say, wait a minute, there's something inherently wrong with this, and there's something inherently bad about especially women, but even men too, being exploited for nothing more than someone else's pleasure, that we ended up with. Now we have a highly sexualized culture that has become super hypersensitized to anything that remotely smacks of sexual harassment. And so you have, and of course with any pendulum swing, Chuck, you have an overswing. You know, it goes farther out than it really needs to sometimes. And I think the pendulum swing may be going farther out. Now, I'm not trying to discount or minimize anybody's pain or issue if and when these things really happen. But, you know, we're getting to the point where, you know, we're having cops sent out on 5-year-olds on the playground for sexual harassment. Okay, let's stop right there. You know, that's probably way over the top. And sometimes you have situations where people will, because they want attention, because they want revenge for some slight, will make accusations against other people that may or may not be legitimate. And so I'm going to withhold a little bit of judgment here on this particular senator. Not saying he didn't do it, because he admitted that, yes, he was inappropriate. When he looked back at his own conduct, he admitted that, yeah, he was probably crossed the line there. And so, you know, to that extent, it's fine. But to the extent that maybe the complaint is being filed, you know, let's see what the complaint says and how far the complainant, this lady who is a staffer who doesn't work in the Senate. And so I parsed that down, Chuck. I figured out what they meant by that, is that she's a staffer for the Legislative Service Commission. Because the LSC sends staffers to staff every committee in the legislature, and this gentleman was the chair of one of the Senate committees. If I have to guess correctly, and I think I will, this was probably one of the staffers, rather an attorney or a research associate, female, who staffed the committee he chaired. Because it's not unlikely to have a chairman have to sit down and have meetings with their LSC staff on committee to talk over amendments or to talk over research requests that members ask for during the course of a committee hearing. And as they say in the movies, one thing led to another, and he crossed the line. He got a little too familiar.
Yeah, it's you put men. I'm not defending this, because men are supposed to control themselves.
Exactly. Men are supposed to be gentlemen, not basically, you know, wolves in sheep's clothing.
I'm gonna say right up front, I've been to the State House and dealt with agencies enough to realize that women who are attracted to political power are yes. usually not exactly dogs. There are a lot of very attractive women involved in different aspects of the legislative process. And, of course, there are also unattractive women who are involved in the legislative process. But it's
but there are an awful lot more unattractive men involved in the legislative process.
Well, that's right.
Just ask me, because I'm one of them.
I was going to say, when I've been down there, everybody's sort of like, you know, it's like the Seinfeld episode with the ugly baby. You know, they all lean over the crib and look in and go, oh, my gosh. So yeah, when I'm down there, I feel the same way. But it's very tempting for a man, and it's a close-in situation. You're doing a lot of work one-on-one sometimes with people, and you become attracted to them, even though you're not married to them. It's a natural thing for men, and men have to guard themselves from that. I don't want to blame the women, because it's not their fault. They simply have the fortune or misfortune to be extremely attractive to men, and men who can't control themselves act on that and allow those kind of feelings to grow. This is one of the problems, Barry, and you've hit on a larger problem. I don't want to segue away from this because I know where you want to go with this. But, you know, you've brought up the whole Harvey Weinstein thing. And now, of course, as we expected it to, it's growing. It's not just Harvey Weinstein. And somebody has brought up, I said, the same bunch that is condemning Harvey Weinstein, and they should condemn. He's been doing this for almost 40 years. I mean, he's been involved in Hollywood production since the 80s. So, we're going on 40 years for him, and he's been doing this since time immemorial. And how many women's lives has he ruined, and how many women has he damaged for life? A lot of them.
I was going to say probably many more than are coming out.
But that being said, the same crowd that is now condemning him was defending him before, and the reason is he's a money bags. Okay.
Right. And we found that out because now, like, a number of these Democrat politicians are scrambling to divest themselves of donations that Weinstein has given to them. But there's one organization that's not divesting themselves of money, and that's Planned Parenthood, who got a $100,000 check from Weinstein right before this whole thing broke. But Cecile Richards, the president of Planned Parenthood, who believes that they're there for empowering women, likes to take money from a guy who's a sexual predator. Why? Well, he may increase the number of abortions they get to.
Well, not only that, the excuse was that the money was already spent. and guess what? Guess who else won't give the money back? The Clinton Foundation.
Oh, what a surprise.
Yeah, Hillary Clinton and Harvey Weinstein were very close. Weinstein was a bundler and was responsible for millions and millions and millions of dollars into Hillary campaign and also foundation pockets. This is one of the reasons that Weinstein was ignored. He was a moneybags who was generous with his donations to good liberal causes. Meanwhile, you know, he's doing his own thing. But one person I want to bring up that everybody's ignoring except an article I found, and I forgot to save a link to it, so I'm looking for it. And that is, people are saying the same people who were defending Harvey Weinstein and dealing with Harvey Weinstein are the same ones who gave think about this, the Motion Picture Association of America and Oscar night a couple of years ago, standing ovation for Roman Polanski.
Uh-huh, yes, that's right.
And defending Roman Polanski and saying things like, oh, we've got to allow him back in. It's unfair that he's done this. You look at what Roman Polanski did. I personally think that what he did was a death penalty offense. If we were doing biblical law, it would have been a death penalty offense. He had drugged a 13-year-old girl. And then
raped her.
And then raped her and sodomized her.
Right.
So it's ugly, folks. And these are the same people who were, now all of a sudden everybody's doing a reexamination. Well, maybe we need to think about this. I mean, the excuses you got was, well, the girl forgave him. Okay, but forgiveness does not mean you don't pay the penalty.
Well, if that's the case, then Harvey Weinstein could just get off the hook by just issuing a blanket apology to everybody, right?
Which he's done. I mean, he's doing we get the reports that he's doing the tearful thing, and this is not me. Of course it's you.
Yep.
This, of course, this is the kind of person you are, because you did it. Now, does that mean you don't like that part of yourself? Gosh, who likes their sin? If they have any kind of conscience at all and they look back on their sin, they regret it. Of course he regrets it. Well, what he really regrets is now all of a sudden he's fallen from power. And he can no longer force beautiful young women to parade around him with their clothes off.
Yeah.
Those days are gone. And he can't force them into sexual situations in order to get the things that he wants. And Roman Polanski can't do that in the United States anymore. Without fear. And why countries are refusing to extradite him is beyond me. Maybe this will be the impetus for him to be extradited. Now, I segued out of that because I think we needed to talk about that. It's a morality issue. It's a morality and ethics issue that goes not just... And part of the reason that guys like the senator you're talking about... And by the way, I have dug up a couple of articles, both from Third Rail Politics and from the Cincinnati Inquirer on this. They're pretty informative, so... Sure. We will probably post those.
We'll link those up, yeah, on the website.
The reason that guy felt free to do that was because, even subtly thinking, if you think about it, the messages that are being sent from media, especially Hollywood, entertainment media, is that kind of thing is okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you'll recall, we spent about the last 3 years of Bill Clinton's presidency with people who were quote-unquote experts that were telling us that certain kinds of sexual activity weren't really sex.
Right. Yeah, you're right. That's exactly what we were getting.
We had all the experts, and in fact, Linda Bloodworth Thomason, who is a Hollywood producer, came out and excoriated Harvey Weinstein and yet defended Bill Clinton. And she wrote an article the other day, again, I have to find it, in which she said, "I will defend Bill Clinton until the last." And when you really get down and parse the article and read it, it's because he was, even though he was a dog, and she admitted that he was a sexual pig, he was good for women. Just not the one. Just not the ones he raped and harassed.
Just not the ones that he actually predated upon.
Now, so. The beauty of it is the ugliness of it is this crosses party lines. It has nothing to do with party. Bill Clinton was a Democrat. Remember Bob Packwood, who got tossed from the Senate. Robert Packwood was a senator from Oregon.
Yes, I do remember that. Yes.
Who got forced to resign from the United States Senate for something similar to what Bill Clinton did. Actually, not as bad as Bill Clinton did. And yet Bill got to keep his job. Now, how did he get to keep his job? Because people like Hillary Clinton and Linda Bloodworth Thomason all came to his defense. All these women came to his defense and said, well, yes, it's bad, but it's not as bad as you think it is. And Hillary just was basically threw the women under the bus and said, it's all them. They're all lying. These things never happened. Everybody else was a little more honest about it. Said, yeah, well, of course, the rape allegations, they all denied. He never did that. Well, yeah, he probably did. He paid a settlement, if you recall. He was forced into a situation in a lawsuit, I think, Juanita Broderick. Maybe it was both Juanita Broderick and the other woman whose name escapes me. I think he was forced to pay them damages from a civil suit since they couldn't get him in a criminal trial. This is why this is important to think about. Men, control yourselves. Yes, men are aggressors. These are facts. And if they think they even see the slightest opening, they'll take it, especially the alpha males. And if a woman doesn't say not only no, but well, emphatically no, you know, they'll take that as a yes. And some men, unfortunately, will take even emphatically no as a yes. But the fact is that once we stray from God's plan for relationships, between men and women. Or in the case of Hollywood, sometimes men and men, because there are a group of men out there who are saying, I've been sexually harassed.
Yeah, exactly. That's the reason why I said it's not just women. And not it just seems that the most of the attention is getting focused on women.
And not by women. Although some of them are saying, well, they have been sexually harassed by women, but some of them are saying they've been sexually harassed by men.
Yeah, as I said, you know, our highly sexualized culture, you know, it's exactly. Everything's open game anymore.
Exactly. So, you know, with the look, you and I both know you can go to your computer right now and type in. Sometimes you can type in things you think are innocent and stuff pops up that you really don't want to look at.
Yeah, well, you know what? I try to avoid that as much as possible.
Well, who, I mean,
that's the reason why you do filtering software. And, you know, you set your search parameters to safe search. And you keep that from happening as much as possible, but especially when you have kids in
that. But it's also so easily available. I mean,
well, it's pervasive is what the problem is, Chuck. I mean, you can't, you know, you mentioned stuff about typing stuff in. How about just going to your news feed? I mean, you go to your news feed and half of the stories, I mean, and Fox News is a major problem with this, too. CNN, I mean, all the major news sources, you know, I can go to Fox News right now. I can scroll halfway down the page and I'm going to see, you know, half naked women.
Okay.
In their features and faces or whatever it comes down to, there's always some kind of salacious story. That these, you know, supposedly, you know, respectable news organs can't help themselves but pick up on.
Well, okay, if you go to the Daily Caller, a site that I check out virtually every day, hence the name, Daily Caller, it's a conservative website. They have a feature called the Smoke Room. And the Smoke Room basically is, you know, bikini pictures.
Okay, never been there. But... You know, here I am, like I said, Fox News. But, well, and this is a legitimate news story, but it kind of gets to what we're talking about here, talk about our culture. And I saw this on somebody's Facebook feed first thing this morning, but they didn't reference an article, and I thought, I hope, you know, I wonder where this is coming from. Well, now I know where it's coming from, because the headline on Fox News this morning is, "Challenge to California's prostitution ban may proceed, judges rule." The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has a three-judge panel has allowed a challenge on constitutionality grounds to the law in California banning legal prostitution on commercial sex. Chuck, this is where we're heading to. And, of course, the Ninth Circuit takes this up and then says that basically prostitution or as the industry is trying to rename itself, sex work, is a legitimate commercial enterprise that can't be, banned by a government. Chuck, that's the point where this culture has become entirely schizophrenic.
And it's all, so
if Harvey Weinstein is in California, if he offered these women money, then, you know, if this ruling goes through, that would have been perfectly okay, because then it's just a commercial transaction, not him using his power and his influence in order to, take advantage of somebody.
Well, exactly. And if you think about it, to show you even how more depraved it is, I just read an article yesterday that in Europe, the first brothels are opening up with these artificial women that are being built.
And it's interesting because as I'm scanning through, I see this one, you know, on the sidebar, and again, this thing with sidebars, but basically saying that these European brothels are already getting requests in these, and of course, folks, we're in the rise of, with virtual reality and everything else, but of course, the Japanese and the Europeans have started perfecting, based on chemical technology, creating dolls, lifelike, full-size, anatomically correct mannequins that, you know, they can use with their technology and stuff, can, you know, have warmth to the touch and everything else for sex. You know, the days of you see the old bachelor party movies with the goofy looking balloon type plastic doll. Yeah. Everybody knows what I'm talking about, so I'm not going to describe it any further.
That's far enough.
That's far arranged. Think now more along the lines of Westworld or some of the other movies where basically or even Blade Runner, Chuck.
Yes.
Replicants.
Yeah.
That's really what we're getting down to. These things don't have sentience and they can't move around on their own. But okay, so you've got these dolls, these anatomically correct and made to specified order dolls that these European brothels are starting to use. They're starting to get requests, Chuck, for rape fantasies.
Yes, all kinds.
And for dolls that are the image of children. Now, supposedly, according to this little sidebar I saw, that they were refusing those requests.
For now.
That's the whole point. Is okay, what point, if the money and the moral decay of our culture goes much further, what do you think? I was talking with my wife about this morning on this thing with the Ninth Circuit. And I said, I can just see that if they do that and they legalize it, it won't be very long before we'll have the temples back again. You know, where you can go and go to a temple prostitute in order to worship at the altar of your favorite, fake god. And let's not kid ourselves. There will be some that will put themselves out there as Christian alternatives.
Yes. Unfortunately.
I hate saying that, but yeah. I just realize where everything in the culture is going right now.
Well, it's no different than the syncretistic religions, if that comes to that, it would be no different than the syncretistic religions that rose out of Judaism in the Old Testament. You maintain your, even, for instance, Abraham, Abraham ended up fooling around with a temple prostitute. Was it Abraham or Isaac? I can't remember now. It's, I got to get back into Genesis and go back and read that.
Okay.
And the woman he ended up fooling around with was his, I can't remember which patriarch this was, but it was his daughter-in-law who disguised herself.
Tamar.
Yes.
You're talking about Tamar. I think that was, okay. That was Isaac, I believe.
I think you're right.
In
any case, that's what happens, folks, when you allow these things to creep in. This isn't really where we were going with this, but it's an important thing to talk about.
Oh, excuse me, not Isaac, Judah. It was Judah.
Okay, we're going to have to look that up and talk about that at some point.
I just did. It's Genesis 38.
Okay. I thought it was Judah's wife.
Okay.
Because it's one of the patriarchs.
Judah went and got... Now, this is what... Genesis 38:6. Judah got a wife for his firstborn,
okay.
And her name was Tamar.
Yes. Okay.
But Judah's firstborn was wicked in the Lord's sight, so the Lord put him to death. And Judah said to Onan, sleep with your brother's wife, fulfill your duty as brother. So Onan basically, wouldn't sleep with her and, did something, that God judged him for.
Right.
And put him to death, too. So, yeah. So basically, then he goes, it's passage of time, he goes... She goes and changes out of her widow's clothes with a veil and basically puts herself forward as a prostitute. And he basically, when Judah saw her, he went over to her and said, hey, let me do this. And, and there was an exchange. He was going to give her a young goat from the flock and a pledge to her. And then she took him in. He slept with her. She got pregnant. And then he sent the goat in order to get the pledge back. He didn't find her, and then he asked about the shrine prostitute.
Yes,
I told you the
shrine
prostitute thing. Yep. And his servant says, I can't find her anywhere. But 3 months later, says, hey, your daughter-in-law is guilty of prostitution because she's pregnant. And so Judah's getting ready to have her, taken care of in the law way, burn her to death. And then she comes out here and says, hey, I'm pregnant by the man who owns these. And she hands him back his pledge tokens.
Yeah.
And so there
Oops.
It is. So,
Oops.
Yes.
Yeah.
Even in the Old Testament, you had this kind of situation.
Now, just again, I know you want to go back to what we were talking about, but I watched a thing on Machiavelli last night. on YouTube.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
It actually was very, very interesting. Machiavellianism feeds right into this. It's a pragmatic thing. It's all about pragmatism. And it was very pragmatic. He syncretized his religion. Judas syncretized. He worshiped God, but he also dealt with this temple prostitute thing. Why? Well, because he got the chance to worship another god with the enticement of dangerous and illegitimate sex, if you think about it. And meanwhile, here's his son's widow, who he was supposed to monitor what's going on there. You know, the Jewish law was that essentially the brother of the dead man was supposed to supply her with a child to continue the family legacy. And he refused to do that. So she concocted this Machiavellian scheme that suited her very well to get her father-in-law to do what he was supposed to do. So it's all very deceitful, and yet it's in the Bible, so it's there for our edification. God just didn't have that part cut out. It's in there, so what are we supposed to learn from it? Man, guard yourselves and do the right thing.
I think more than anything, that's the moral of the story, is that Judah did things that were wrong to start with, and they created other consequences that he ended up having to, be accountable for at the end. He didn't have, you know, the separation where he could play judge and jury against his daughter-in-law, because supposedly she had prostituted herself, because he was the one who made her a prostitute.
Yes, exactly. He forced her into a situation where she had to do that. We've all heard the situations where women had nothing left to do but sell themselves. That's not the way that men are supposed to allow that to happen. And yes, is it men's responsibility? You bet it is.
Right. Well, Chuck, before we like run out of time here, I think the other thing we need to do today is talk about the two statewide ballot issues that folks are finding on their ballots. You know, early voting has already started. We're almost toward the end of October, and so there are a number of people who will pull early ballots, and we apologize we didn't get to this earlier. Not today, but earlier, like maybe at the beginning of the month, that there are two ballot issues that are going to be facing everybody when they go for the statewide ballot, issues one and issues two. Issue one is, and you know, Chuck, we could do a fair and balanced approach on this and just talk about the pros and the cons of both of these, but I'm just going to be quite frank, both of these issues, there's definitely been a huge amount of money and, media that has been pushed toward a particular side of each one of these issues. And honestly, at least with issue one, I'm on the other side of it. I'm not buying the cultural zeitgeist on this thing. So issue one, which is labeled the rights for crime victims. Well, is that we don't have any rights for crime victims in Ohio? Well, that's not true. We have plenty of rights for crime victims. They're in the state statute books. But this issue would try to elevate all this to the level of a constitutional requirement. And the arguments for this thing are that basically this is based on a law that came out of California, where you had a violent crime, and then the perpetrator of the violent crime was let loose from prison. And the family was not of the victim was not informed of this fact, and they basically had a confrontation accidentally by running into the perpetrator in a grocery store. And of course, things ensued, and so all over time they passed this law, but they didn't have these notification laws. But really, when it gets right down to it, the vast majority of all of these issues are either already dealt with in state statute or can be dealt with by a small amendment to the state statute rather than putting this in the Constitution. Basically, they want to notify crime victims during each step in the legal process. Well, if a crime victim requests that, they can get that to start with. This is going to just basically force it that, the prosecutor, the state, or whatever, has to just create all this extra notification. You may argue that that's a good thing. That's fine. I just think that, if a crime victim wants to be notified and kept in the loop of what's going on with the case of their alleged perpetrator, then they have the right to ask that to start with. Basically says that the crime victims and their family members have the right to be present in the courtroom and a voice in the judicial process. Well, Chuck, I don't know too many courtrooms where the victim or the family members are barred from sitting in and hearing the case or are not witnesses or deposed on the stand in the case. Obviously, you have a victim, you have to be able to find out from the victim's perspective what happened. Now, you know, if you're dealing with a young child, they take some special precautions. Sure, but again, they already provide for this. And then basically, it's the crime victims and their family members have input into plea bargains as well as financial restitution from the offender, if appropriate. Okay, well, again, a plea bargain situation is that, you don't have enough evidence to try somebody for X, and so you're trying to get them to go ahead and save the court time and money by getting them to plead to a lower case that you know you've got the evidence to convict them on.
Exactly. Why take first a second-degree murder pleas because you can't prove first, but you can prove second.
Yeah, you can prove same, but you can't prove first. But, if you put a crime victim in there, they're going to want to go for everything they
absolutely.
So does this give a crime victim's family a veto power over a plea bargaining? This is part of the reason why the State Prosecuting Attorneys Association is opposing this issue. And I agree with them.
No, this is
but,
why.
You know, as you and I talked about it, the biggest thing I have an issue with in issue one, and it's something that we need to think about carefully. There's a provision in issue one that puts limits on the right of the defense to seek discovery in a case. Now, Chuck, discovery is when you get a chance to examine and investigate and depose people regarding the evidence of the case. And in a number of instances, it's during this discovery process that you find out that an accused isn't the perpetrator.
Oh, yeah.
And these people are not then put through court trials and potentially imprisonment on shoddy or fabricated evidence. And, gee, we know that never happens, right?
Oh, we know it happens a lot.
Unfortunately, it happens more often than you care to imagine.
Let's not make it sound like it's 50% of cases, because it's not. It's a significant enough percentage of cases that people are collecting large damages for prosecutors who are overzealous and laboratories and police investigations that suppress some evidence and bring others to the forefront. It does happen.
It does happen. It's not in every case. That's right. And it's not 50% of the cases. Although I'm not even really sure what the percentage is. It may be. We just may be not knowing the full extent of it. But I don't believe that that it is. But anyhow, you get right down to it here. The other thing that this problem, let's go back to our situation with the state senator. Okay, yes, okay, let's look at that pattern that, yes, it's the individual brings a charge of sexual harassment or brings a complaint to whom? I don't know. They didn't bring it to law enforcement, as far as I can tell. They brought it to the legislative leadership. Well, let's just say, let's hypothetically look at this for a second, that perhaps there's a situation where a number of individuals, maybe not within that particular body, but politically outside, would benefit from being able to play some musical chairs in order to create a more stable environment for another political thing that they're working on. And I'm being very obtuse here, folks, because I'm trying to set up a hypothetical, and I really don't want to have people going, oh, well, that's what's happening. Although that was the first thing I thought of when this whole thing broke, was that this was a major setup on some other particular piece that was going on. And that's just my paranoia when it comes to all things political around Capitol
and
Square.
And your experience. Your experience.
My experience in knowing that my paranoia is justified most of the time. But let's just say that, somebody gets wind of this and they realize that something's happening and this person hasn't come forward quite yet. And an individual comes forward and promises maybe an easy access to a really nice apartment or, a new car or money that shows up in their bank account, if the individual will, you know, create this complaint against this politician. Now, folks, yeah, I know it sounds like a John Grisham novel, but yeah, it happens.
It does happen.
But let's say that, okay, we get to this point where the complaint's filed and it's harassment and all this other stuff. And yeah, there's this little bit of thing and there's this Ashley Madison stuff. And so you've got all this circumstantial evidence. And so they're going to go take this and they're going to take this guy to the woodshed. You know, we're going to go after him. And so they go through this whole thing and get into a court. Well, if this provision passes, that politician's attorney may be denied the right to look at communications or bank account information or to ask questions of this crime victim who may or may not be involved in a setup of the defendant. Now, folks, it can happen. I'm not saying it did happen in this situation. I don't think it did, but knowing that that's something that could happen, I mean, that's part of the reason why I have a big problem with issue one.
Yeah.
Because I do honestly believe that limiting the right of a discovery, because the victim, that's harassment. If you start asking me all these questions about you wanting my diaries and, you know, my past sexual history and all that. No, that sometimes is relevant to your state of mind. It's relevant to your personality. It's relevant to everything, especially if the victim of crime, it's a sexual nature. And that gets us all the way back to what we were talking about earlier. So, you know, like I said, the vast amount of money and media are pushing for a yes vote on issue one because of, well, we need to have rights for crime victims, which is an emotional plea, Chuck.
Yep, sure
and if
is.
If you look at their yes defense, there's nothing out there but emotional pleas in it. Whereas the argument against is actually written by a representative from the Ohio Public Defender's office, who even they don't think this is a good idea. They think this is ridiculous because they said in 1998, Ohio implemented one of the nation's first automated victim notification systems, which offers victims information 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. So what are we doing with this bill? How does this improve things?
It
says basically, yeah, if they're not receiving assistance they're entitled to by law, then provide additional resources and training, which is a legislative matter for the budget, not amend the state constitution.
Yeah, we are short on time, and we do want to talk about issue two, too. So I would say...
Okay, fire away. I'll let you run issue two.
You know, I first of all, I would say we are recommending a no vote on this, and we're recommending it because all this stuff doesn't need to be in the constitution. It needs to be done by statute. And chances are this will big provisions of this will not survive a court challenge.
No, I hope not if it passes, because the big provisions of this are redundant and or dangerous to true justice.
Okay, now let's talk about issue two. We've got about 5 or 6 minutes, so we can talk about issue two. Issue two, what exactly does issue two do, Barry?
Issue two basically changes the Ohio statute. I change the statute by the Constitution to require that the state has to be able to, they can't charge, or the agencies of the state cannot pay more for prescription drugs that they then deliver to their folks, and that's like Department of Mental Health, Department of Health, JFS, things of that nature, Veterans Affairs. Then the federal Department of Veterans Affairs pays for them, and then it requires state payment of attorney's fees and expenses to specific individuals for defense of the law. So it's basically you've got a situation where an individual who is very wealthy and who supplies a number of these pharmaceuticals to states through contracts is trying to set up a situation where, you know, okay, you have to buy from, you know, someone who's getting, you know, at the same pay level as the Federal Department of Veterans Affairs. Now, is that good? Well, it can be, but it really, remember, it's only for state agencies. It's not for private, you know, private companies. This just basically says that, you know, when the state is buying drugs, then in dealing with the state, you have to go by federal regulation. In other words, what's the Federal Department of Veterans Affairs paying for it? You know, it sounds like a great thing to save, you know, save a lot of money. And of course, they talk about all these things, you know, that that it would save a bunch of money because, and they use the whole issue with the EpiPen thing, where, where Joe Manchin's daughter, who ran the company, decided that since they were really the biggest sole source of this drug, for, you know, allergies, that they could charge $600 a dose for it. Well, yeah, that's pretty bad.
Yeah.
And of course they talk about the opioid thing, but this will not address either one of those.
That's right.
Because
doesn't touch
Mylan
either one.
Yeah. Is a private company. Now, do they buy from places like, or does the state buy from Mylan for schools? Sure does. But you know, the whole point is that if the Federal Department of Veterans Affairs says, how many EpiPens do you believe that the Federal Department of Veterans Affairs are buying?
A lot.
Well, they probably are. And so they're probably getting quantity discounts.
Exactly.
Now, again, that's the federal department versus the state department. You know, so they're getting discounts. So what's this going to do to manufacturers?
Yeah. Chuck?
I mean, if you're a manufacturer and you're told that, okay, you're giving a 60% discount to this federal agency, you have to give a 60% discount to this small state agency, let's say Rhode Island, but let's say Ohio, since we're talking about Ohio. Are you going to actually be able to produce and deliver the quantities they want at the price point that you would if you were making the quantities at a federal agency?
Yeah, and see, that's the problem. Here's the way issue two works. It only applies to people on private and employer-based insurance. In other words, issue two only applies to state agencies and entities. It won't do anything for two-thirds of the Ohio's population. Two-thirds, right, of the population who buy their own health insurance or get it through a private employer or otherwise don't obtain their prescription drugs through state programs. In other words, it essentially applies to people who are on relief situations, who are getting it through Medicaid, who are getting it through veterans deals, who are getting it through any kind of a situation where you're uninsured, essentially, is who it applies to. Now, what does that do to the rest of us? And why would it possibly cost those people more money to get the thing? You brought it up. The prices are negotiated.
Right.
What does it do suddenly when you have to sell onesie-twosies at the negotiated bulk price? Where does it shift the burden?
It shifts the burden to the producer, who won't be able to,
yes,
actually be able to manufacture at that rate because he'll be losing money.
That's right. They're selling. What it basically does is it shifts the cost back over to the people who you're trying to give relief to. It shifts the burden back to the people who are negotiating a bulk price. Why is that? Because there are production costs. And when you go in and buy a 90 days worth of a drug versus somebody who's selling 7 million or 3 or 4 million units of 90 days of a drug, it's a lot cheaper to supply that. Well, what does that do? You have to shift the cost from the person, the individual buyer who's suddenly getting this price. So what does it do? Everybody's price goes up.
Everybody's price goes up.
Because once you raise the price of the negotiated price, it automatically raises the price of the non-negotiated price. It has to by law at this point. So what you're doing is putting in the statute.
The non-negotiated price has to go up in a almost geometric increase versus the price of the negotiated.
Exactly. We're going to end up way over on this, but let's be clear about one provision that you mentioned that is important to know, is that it basically guarantees that lawyers get paid. Any attorneys filing suit on the basis of this amendment get paid, win or lose. Is that a problem? Well, if you look at who basically is the sponsor of this constitutional amendment, it's a big law firm. It's a big healthcare law firm who basically wants to be able to file suit for all kinds of things and get paid.
Oh, of course.
So that's the bottom. Our recommendation in that case is a no vote on both issues one and two.
Absolutely.
No on one, no on two. These are not good for Ohio. They're terrible. They're not good for anybody. So that being said, we are out of time. And our apologies for ending so abruptly, but that's the way of the world. You know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.